Thank you for listening to this podcast brought to you by the Center for Christian Music Studies at Baylor University. This podcast was recorded at the 2011 Alleluia Conference. In this session titled, The Female Adolescent Voice, Lauren Shively will explore the stages of vocal change, introduce relevant materials, and present how we as music educators can help to ease young singers through this sometimes frustrating transition. To learn more about the Alleluia Conference, visit us online at www.baylor.edu/alleluia.
Minnesota, and I'm from Seattle, where I participated in a girl choir program for 12 years, and it was actually one of the first girl choirs created in the entire country. So it's really exciting to be a part of that tradition. And I remember being in girl choir when I was young and wondering what it was that made the girls sound so different from every age group, because the choirs were broken up into four different ages with a select ensemble at the top. And I remember thinking, they really sound different. And I remember the second youngest choir having this breathy sound, and everybody would just groan when they'd come on stage when we'd have to listen to them. And I always wondered why, because when you think about young boys and the boys changing voice, there's such a huge difference. And, you know, you hear them go through all these crazy voice breaks, and you hear them change and add an extra octave or two on the bottom. And, you know, it seemed like with girls, there was nothing going on, except for that sometimes they sound pretty, and then they sound kind of icky for a while, and then they start sounding better. And finally, they get to their young adolescent voice. So when I got to grad school, I realized that Dr. Lynn Gackle was here, and she is the most renowned person in the field of the female adolescent voice. Her dissertation was one of the first works on this. So I decided, of course, while I was here, that I should take the time to study with her, because what better chance am I going to have to study the adolescent voice of the female besides with her? So first semester of last year, I took an independent study, and I created my own class, and this is what I studied. So this presentation should be some of the most up-to-date and thorough information that there is, so hopefully you'll enjoy it. So why I think it's important to say this is that there is a place for all of God's children in choir, and we don't really know much about the female adolescent voice, so it's interesting that we don't, just because there are 50% of the kids in choir, sometimes 60 or 70 depending on your program. So we really should know more about them so that we can keep them there and help them become better musicians. Reasons that it hasn't been studied. Well, male voice has been more accepted historically. I mean, if you think back to Baroque and Renaissance, you've got boys singing the soprano and alto part. You don't have any women in the mix. So women really weren't accepted until the 1970s and 80s in the children's choir movement. And this is the first time that young girls were allowed in community choirs. So this was a big shift and exciting thing. So that's about when my girl choir was formed. And then in 1991, the English church choirs decided to allow young girls into their program. And sadly, only one-third of them, or sorry, as of 2002, only one-third of them had been successful in allowing girls into their program. So there were still two-thirds that were boys only. And of those third of those schools, only three of them actually mixed the students. So they were still separate, not together. So that's wild to me to think that just 9 years ago, only a third of the schools were teaching girls, and only three schools in all of England. I mean, you think about church choirs, and where do you go? Young children's choirs, you go to England. So that's wild to me. And I mean, the research still remains very lacking. Most of my sources that I've come up with, which are on your bibliography sheet, have been within the last 5 or 10 years, and in fact, the first entire book devoted to the female adolescent voice wasn't published until this March. by Dr. Gackel. There had been books with articles dealing with the female Allison voice, or books dealing with male Ed and female Allison voice, but it'd be like, you know, a huge amount male and a tiny amount female. In fact, when I took a class on the Allison voice in college, we spent all but one day on the male changing voice and one day on the female changing voice, which is sad to me. I mean, it's important. There were 50% of the people are women. So that's why we're here. Why is the changing male voice so much more noticeable than that of the female? Well, in males, your larynx lengthens, thickens, and widens, whereas with females, it only thickens and widens, so there's no lengthening going on. As well, the vocal folds lengthen from 17 to 28 millimeters, which is 66%, 66, almost 67% increase, whereas the females only lengthen to 23, which is a 24% increase. So, I mean, that accounts for all of the range that you're gaining right there. And then in males, you know, you have an octave to two octaves down. And females, they actually, maybe they'll get a note or two on the top that they didn't have, and they'll gain a third on the bottom. So that's hardly anything in comparison. But, of course, it's not just about the range that you're gaining as a female, it's the feelings that your voice goes through that's important. So why I think it's so important is that a lot of, this is a quotation from a book that I read. It says, appropriate voice classification is absolutely crucial during the pubertal voice transformation. Without it, many youngsters conclude on their own that their voices have become inadequate and they may stop singing, sometimes for the rest of their lives. A lot of young girls, when they're 8 or 9, they're praised for their beautiful little soaring flute-like sound, and then they go through the part where it gets all breathy and nobody really wants to listen to them anymore, and they notice. I mean, I don't think my voice went through that quite as much, but I remember hearing other girls where I was like, what happened to their voice? And then they'd come back later and be great, but you know, it's like that 2 or 3 or 4, maybe even 5 year period where the children aren't praised for their beautiful singing voices anymore. It can be incredibly emotionally damaging. So the 4 stages of voice change, these have been put together by Dr. Gackel. She basically read every source on the male changing voice known to man and came up with a way to classify the female voice based on their system, but changed for the female. So she came up with 4 stages. Stage 1 is the prepubertal stage. Stage 2A is the pubescent/premenarchial stage. Stage 2B is the puberty/postmenarchial stage. And stage 3 is the young female or postmenarchial stage. So she came up with these stages on 6 different categories. So the first is physical growth, being height or weight. Skeletal and muscular development, appearance of the secondary molars in the back, growth of pubic and axillary hair, breast development, which she classifies as thelarch, and onset of menstruation, which she classifies as menarche in her book. And then in order for people to listen to their children and figure out what they sound like, she's classified them based off of their average speaking pitch, their vocal range and tessitura, their register development, basically by just finding the passaggi, and by their overall vocal quality or timbre as they go through the progression. So stage 1, the prepubertal stage. This stage generally occurs for kids between ages 8 and 10, but it can extend as far as 12 or 13, depending on when they go through puberty, because this is before puberty, before any signs of change. So their singing range is usually a B-flat 3 to an F-5, and their tessitura is somewhere between a D-4 and a D-5. And then this is that beautiful childlike quality, the flute-like sound, which is often called the pure sound. And how can you spot it? There aren't any register breaks that you can really hear, and they're pretty flexible throughout all of their range. And it has a very similar quality to the typical boy soprano, except for that they're lacking a lot of the volume that a boy would have, because the boys can really punch that volume. It's a very intense sound, I guess. So here's an example of an 8-year-old singing Ave Maria. pubescence or premenarchal stage. This is from ages 11 to 12, extending as late as 13. Takes place at the first signs of physical maturity. So this is like the very onset of puberty. Their range is from A3 to G5, and their testosterone is generally D3 to D4. And this is the first appearance of a register break that is at G4 to B4. Their quality, this is when the breathiness starts coming into play. I'm sure y'all have heard that before. and this is because of what is called a mutational chink, which is an inadequate closure of the vocal folds as growth occurs. So, you know, they're going like this and they're like gaps when they're vibrating together.
So they really can't help it.
Yeah, unfortunately.
Yeah.
It's not their fault. So how can you spot it? This is a lot of time when girls say that they're uncomfortable singing. The breathiness a lot of times makes them feel kind of raspy or hoarse. It can make their voice sore. I mean, there's really not much that you can do about it, but it is something to consider. A lot of girls try to push through the breathiness, and that is awful. So don't ever let them do that, because that, I mean, they can do some really horrible physical damage that can be permanent to their vocal cords. And it's just, I mean, I don't think it's a very pleasing sound to push through it. I mean, I'd rather listen to the breathy than the pushing. They also have trouble with volume in their upper and middle ranges. And the breathier sound in the head voice, I mean, it generally sticks towards the head voice, but they still have a little bit of a fuller sound on the bottom, which is why a lot of girls will try to push, because they'll try to bring up that chest voice. And that's when, you know, you've got the theater sound coming in with the belting. We don't need that in church. So, and then since this is their first experience with a register break, a lot of times you can hear that register break, and it's a very apparent flip because they haven't figured out how to mix the registers yet. So a lot of great things that you can be doing are helping to bridge that gap by doing, you know, ascending or descending scales that go right through that area. This is an example of another young girl. She is 11, and you'll hear the breathiness coming into her. She apologized about the sermon. Later is about how you pick good repertoire for them. Okay, then we move to stage 2B, which is puberty or postmenarchial. So this is ages 13 to 14, extending into 15. You know, this is like end of junior high, early high school, depending on how old they are. We've got the range from A3 to A5 with the tessitura of B-flat 3 to C5, and now they have two breaks to deal with, which is just makes it even harder. So now they've got G4 to B4 and D5 to F-sharp 5 that are troubling them. So it's just one more thing working against them and putting in those psychological effects that just make it no fun to be a girl at this age. It's already hard enough as it is. So, and then this is when you start hearing that huskier sound, the and then how can you spot it? Well, husky quality. I think that's the most obvious sign. That's how I spot it automatically. They still have that easier sound and feeling to the lower notes. The weight and timbre begin shifting. They start getting a little bit more weight in their voice. And then hoarseness is added because of that husky quality. and they start to get some voice cracks too. So girls get voice cracks too. It's not just guys, and people don't realize that. And then, you know, they're still uncomfortable, and it's really unfortunate. This is actually the stage where they're at the peak of their mutation. So it's going to be the worst. Everything is just going wild.
They're not writing that with it.
So this is when they're going through all sorts of changes. And and a lot of times, right here, they're left with a really narrow range, and they get really frustrated. Mm-hmm. They don't have those notes that they used to have. And it's awful. You know, you think, I used to have no problem singing up here, and now it's all breathy, and it sounds awful, and then my registers don't match. I have this loud, booming, normal sound. I mean, it's sort of growing into an adult sound on the bottom, and I've got this breathy sound on top, and it just doesn't mix. And so they get frustrated because it's like, well, how do I sing a whole song if I'm singing with two different voices? It's not, it can be really frustrating. So, and then a lot of people qualify this as an impure tone. It can get a little uncomfortable to listen to at times. So here's a singing clip. They're all different auto areas, but postmenarchial stage. This occurs at age 15 generally, but you know, some people can be later. Sometimes it's 16 or 17, but generally it's around 15. Their range, they finally have a full two octaves from A3 to A5, and usually they're so happy. And then you have a tessitura of A3 to G5. The quality, this is when they start getting some of that richness that you hear in the high school and even going into the college level. Starts to sound more like a young adult female instead of an adolescent. How can you spot it? Well, they have their big range, their nice two-octave range. Their voices are more consistent, and they have an easier time singing through their breaks. They have an easier time singing through the mixed register, and the passaggi points are much easier for them. There's less breathiness. They have that deep, rich sound. Singing is easier. They start to get some vibrato. It's just much freer, and they finally feel like they can sing in one consistent voice, which is a great part in their life. And then also their volume, resonance, and vocal agility are generally improved. Here is an example. I think this girl's 15. Yeah. Today. manufactured darkness into her sound. But you can just hear that she has much more control. The sound is more consistent through the register. She has more agility. I mean, she just sounds more comfortable, which is great. Sorry about that. Filming. I don't do a very good job of these. So then how can we apply this knowledge? We have to think about how we can ease students through these frustrating times. So that they don't stop singing, because we want people to keep singing. So the first thing to consider is age and grade. How are we going to go about placing these kids? There are two methods to arranging choirs. Obviously, there's the age arrangement, or by grade, you can say, you know, 3 to 5 year old, or not 3 to 5 year olds. Well, I guess you could have that, but you could have 7 to 9 year olds in this group. Or generally, it's good to, if you're going to group by ages, it's good to try and group in those ages of those, of the stages of change, because then you've got girls who are going through the same thing. However, I advocate for age overlapping programs, because you've got different girls at different stages of change. But not just that, it's also important to take into account their skill level and their emotional maturity. So we're going to go through that and talk about maybe the benefit to not just doing age-decided programs, because that's what most churches do, and I think that that is not necessarily the best idea. I guess the reason that I feel so strongly about this is because in my girl choir, I was one of the kids that was always the very youngest in the choir, because I loved singing. I loved theory books. I would ask my band and choir teachers for theory books, and I would just fill them out in my fun time, because that's what I thought was fun. I'm not a normal person. But I loved learning how to sight read. I mean, I would literally like take my mom's Mozart Requiem score or whatever, and I would sit there and I would sight read it, or I'd be like, Mom, can I go to a rehearsal? And I'd just sing through it in my head, or I'd get to sing through it. I loved being able to read music without having somebody play it for me, so I was very far ahead of where everybody else my age was, and I was also a pretty mature kid. I mean, I helped take care of my sister and all that, so I was always so frustrated about people that were my age, and I always was so happy that I got to be with the kids that were singing at my level, that could sing in tune, that could read music, could sing music that wasn't necessarily super tonal. And so I was so thankful that the program that I was in was age overlapping. My school program was not age overlapping, and so that's where I felt the other effects of that. And I just felt held back. So I appreciate it. So I'm going to prove to you why it's a good way to do it. So age and grade. Now by asking them this at their placements, if you have a chance to do placements or talk with them before you put them in choir, this is a good way just to help you find out from the very beginning where they might be in their vocal maturity. It helps you narrow down, maybe one or two stages that they could be in. And it might give you an idea of where they are emotionally or maturity-wise. Not a perfect ruler, but it'll at least give you a place to start. So then you move to physical maturity. You can look at them to find some things out, you know, how far they're along in puberty. I mean, you've got some obvious ways to tell. So then you can kind of figure out where they might be physically, vocally, what stage of change they might be in by vocalizing them or having them sing a song for you. You just use the things that I just taught you to find out where they might be. So then you have to consider skill level. You have to figure out what a student might add to an ensemble skill-wise. Can they match pitch? Do they stay in tune? Can they sing harmony against melody? Can they sing melody while harmony is being played? Can they sing harmony when there's more than one harmony part? There are a lot of different things to consider. Also, how well can they sight read music? Can they clap rhythms? Can they do solfege? Can they sight read on solfege? There's just a lot of things to consider. So once you decide where someone is skill-wise, I think it's a little easier if they're really far along skill-wise to say, well, maybe they're a year young for this ensemble, but they're with the other kids in their skills. And I mean, along with that goes emotional maturity. There are two forms of emotional maturity, how I define them. There's personal maturity, which shows how well a student cares for herself and how well she's independent of her parents. And you can tell a lot by just meeting somebody with their parents. Do they speak for themselves or do they let their parents answer for them? Can they answer the questions that you answer or do they look to their parents for approval? And also how well she can control herself on her own. Is she appropriate? And then the other thing to consider is social maturity. And that's how they act in groups. So do they isolate themselves? Do they just sit by themselves when they're in large groups? Or are they the people causing lots of trouble? Or are they somewhere in between? So I remember in my girl choir experience, there were a lot of girls who had great voices and who actually had decent skills, but they didn't have the maturity that was involved and they were held behind. That was, I think, the number one thing that they considered when they moved people up and down, because they're gonna hold the whole group back if they're constantly talking or, I mean, I remember girls passing around magazines in choir rehearsal. That's not okay. So they were the ones who were held back. And I thought that was a great thing because then we got to move forward and make good music. And so then I guess I would say the second most important thing is skill level. You have to decide if they're going to be able to make it. A lot of kids got held back because they couldn't sight read or because they had trouble singing harmony, because we would switch parts all the time because that is a little bit better on your voices. But then, of course, you still have to consider age and grade while you're considering those things, because you can't put an 8-year-old in a choir with 13 and 14-year-olds. Like, that's just not okay. So you kind of have to make a boundary somewhere. But it's great to consider the option that maybe a 12-year-old belongs with the 13 and 14-year-olds, and maybe a 12-year-old belongs with the 10 and 11-year-olds. So it's just something to weigh, something to consider. The next thing that is important are your music choices. With solo music, I would suggest looking for books that say for all ages or for younger singers, but you have to still have to be so critical. With music for younger children, there's a lot of bad music out there. There's music that seems like it's easy, but the range is too big, or the text isn't necessarily something that's appropriate for a young child. There's a lot of stuff that you have to consider when you're picking the music, besides if it sounds pretty and if you think they can sing it. Because just because they can sing it doesn't mean it's comfortable for them, and it doesn't mean that it's good for them. Let's see what else. Oh, and then for choral series, I actually really think that the choral series are the best way to go. So if you go with series by Helen Kemp or Doreen Rao or Henry Leck, people who are known for their work with children, they generally have a better idea of what works with children because they've actually taken the time to do it with children, rather than looking at it and saying, well, this looks okay. This would probably work for children. Let's put it in a choral series. So with choral series, I have an entire library of tons of kids' pieces, and I try to stick with the ones that have been done by people who work with kids, because they know. They've experienced it. They've done it. They've done it all. So, but of course, the most important thing is that it fits the range and tessitura of the girls. Even though the girls may, especially when they're in that part where the high range is tough, even though they have it, it doesn't necessarily mean that it's great to use it all the time. So stick for pieces that might have a lower tessitura and then throw in one or two pieces that have the higher range. And what I thought was kind of a good idea is maybe choosing something that's harder for their brains and less work on their voice. So choosing a piece with really interesting rhythms or something that's not necessarily quite as tonal. I think that's a great way to challenge them without challenging their voices when they feel like they're having a hard time. Another thing is just check in with them and see how they're doing on the music. Maybe talk to a few of your students that are some of your better students that are good at voicing their opinions, and ask them, you know, like, how does this song feel? How do you think this song is going? Do you like this song? Is it tough for you? Getting a read on your kids can be a really good way of figuring out whether or not something is working and if you would want to do it again. Because just because it sounds okay doesn't mean that it feels okay. And the most important thing that I want to stress is that it needs to feel okay, because we don't want to hurt these kids. And then as far as the kids who have narrow ranges, sometimes it's a good idea to find a way to find pieces that aren't in a huge range. And a lot of times it's great to find pieces that have two parts that are in very similar ranges and they just kind of play around with each other. Because then you can have, you know, you don't want, some kids will want to not just sing the top part all the time or the bottom part all the time. So one thing that I've read about is having two, is you just take your choir and you divide it in half. I mean, you try and make it equal halves and you call one the purple half and one the green half, or, you know, you can come up with any sort of term that you want. And then you say, okay, purple half gets to sing the top part today. And then maybe, okay, on this piece, purple half's gonna sing the bottom. And then they don't feel like there's any sort of reason that they're picked for any specific purpose. And it's hard to classify young girls as sopranos or altos because you don't really know where they're gonna end up yet. So that, I mean, there were so many people who got stuck singing alto just because they could sight read. And I was one of them in the high school choir, and it's painful. It doesn't feel good, but I was the only person that could sing harmony. So I got stuck there, and that was frustrating because there were other people who could have figured out how to sing harmony if they really were asked to. So I think it's a great idea, especially for the younger kids, just to have the two halves and have them switch all the time, because then they never feel like, oh, I'm a soprano, I'm so special, or they like form these weird clips. It is strange. Little kids are strange. I don't know. So then the most important thing is working through those transitions, the breaks, and trying to work through the register. Warm-ups can be a great way to do this. It's a great time in your rehearsal to get a chance to work with this. Choosing warm-ups that help ease them through their difficult breaks is a great idea. So you can use things like simple scalar passages. A lot of times they feel more comfortable with the descending exercises, but you can do some that are ascending too. That's not discouraged or anything. Choosing the appropriate repertoire that's not going to emphasize those breaking points, especially when they have those points where their voices literally flip. It's really good to try to not pick pieces that focus right around that spot, because then they'll constantly be flipping and it's uncomfortable, and they get frustrated that you know each half sounds different. So you try to just pick pieces that stay either lower or maybe a little bit higher, or they don't hover around that middle line. You just kind of, they move through it. Go through periodic checkups if at all possible. A lot of people do end of the year or beginning of the year checkups, and that gives you a great chance to just figure out where they are and how you can help them individually. And just, I mean, it's hard to hear sometimes where everybody is when you're hearing everybody individually is. So that's a great chance to figure out where the majority of your kids are struggling. Encouraging proper technique is crucial. Don't ask them to push. Especially things like standing up straight can help them. I mean, just in general, anything that you think is good technique, encourage it, because even though they're having a hard time, it's gonna make it easier and you're gonna not have to reinforce the proper technique later. That's a good thing. I think also being open about voice change with students is a great thing to do. You know, saying, you know, I know that this is tough. At this point in your life, your voice is naturally a little bit breathier. I don't want you to push through that. I want you to sing how your voice is supposed to sing. Don't try to change it, because God gave you this voice and it's beautiful. And your voice is going to grow. And you just have to let it do it naturally, because if you let it grow naturally, it's going to be beautiful. So just taking the time to really reinforce that what's happening is okay. What's happening happens to all girls. What happens to some people worse than others, just like anything else in life. But I think that if they know that that's what they're supposed to expect and that that's what they're supposed to go through, then it makes it a little bit easier, because a lot of girls feel like they're the only ones. They just don't notice that everybody else is going through the exact same thing. They just think it's them and something's wrong with them and maybe they should stop singing. And you literally lose girls just like that. And they're just gone. And the final thing that I'd suggest is not encouraging real, I put it in quotes, voice lessons until they're through the tougher parts of voice change. Now, I took voice lessons starting when I was like 11. But they were voice lessons that was like, oh, let's sing some songs. Let's work on dynamics and let's learn how to sing in different languages. It wasn't actually technique lessons. And so don't encourage them to take the real voice lessons until they're through the majority of their maturing, because it can do some damage, especially when teachers don't realize. A lot of teachers will push through the parts of change and they'll try to have people sing through their breathiness, and there are some interesting teachers out there, so beware of them. And if you can, if you know teachers in the area, try to recommend your students to specific teachers so that they don't go and find anybody. That way you have a better control of whether they're going to pop lessons or actual voice lessons, and you have a chance to find out whether or not the teachers are teaching proper technique. And I do think it's important as an educator to seek out those teachers and talk to other teachers in your area and find out where they send their kids, because you really, I mean, it's gonna help you if they go to lessons and you want them to be being helped in the right way. Relevant materials for further study. If you wanna learn anything more, this is literally the list. I have searched every database that Baylor has access to, which is basically everything. So if you want to learn more, this is where you'll find it. The first article, this one by Doherty, this article helps you with classification during the audition process. So this just goes into detail a little bit more about the stages like I talked about. Then the next article is okay, the next article is by Fryer, and this is a great beginning source. It was written a while ago, so it's not quite as up to date as a lot of the other articles, but this was one of the first articles I read, and I thought it was a great basic approach to female voice change. And then the Gackle 2006 article, this article summarizes and builds on the research that she had already done, and it examines the psychological effects of voice change, which I think are fascinating. The psychological things that girls go through as they go through voice change. And then her 1991 article was one of the very first articles, and it was just a very basic approach to classifying female adolescent voices. And this is, I think, one of the articles that kind of jump-started the research. It's very well written. It's not a super long read. You can find it online, I'm pretty sure, by searching just the title. The Peterson article, I wouldn't recommend reading this unless you want to read some really scientific material. It is all numbers and big words, and it's quite a bear to get through. So I wouldn't suggest this unless you're really looking for something specific. And again, it's from over 20 years ago, so it's not super current with what we know now. And then the final article is by Welch. And this is the one that talked about the battle in adding the girls into the churches in England and what's happened there. The next, the books. So, Body, Mind, and Voice, Foundations of Voice Education. This is a book, or not a book, but a three-volume set that the Voice Care Network put out a few years back. I guess 11 years back. I loved this book. I thought it was so interesting. I mean, it's a lot of books, so it's maybe like this thick, and I think it costs like $140 to buy, so it's not a cheap edition, but if you can go to a library and look through it, I think it's really interesting. It had some of the articles were just really interesting in it. I really enjoyed it, but again, it's really expensive, so it's not exactly the kind of book that anybody can just go out and buy. But I would suggest buying the book by Dr. Gackle that just came out called Finding Ophelia's Voice, Opening Ophelia's Heart, Nurturing the Adolescent Female Voice. I think it has come out, but it's not on Amazon yet, so I don't know if you can like buy it, but I'm pretty sure that you can buy it through the publisher, Heritage Music. I got a chance to actually read the manuscript while I was doing my research, and I just thought it was incredible. Dr. Gekkel is an incredibly warm and caring person in the way that she writes, and she really cares about this topic, and so I think it's written in a way that's really special. And I mean, it's really the only book that exists, and I think it's a great start. It's really a great start. And it also includes a CD of speaking and singing examples. So she gives you examples of what the different voices sound like. I think that was really cool, because she helped me listen to it in her office, and it really gave me a good chance to know what I was supposed to be listening for, because it goes along with, you know, writing, where she's like, this is what you should be hearing, and I thought it was a great tool. I mean, who knew that that would be available? So that's really cool. I think the book runs around $45, but I really think it's worth having if you're working with a lot of females. So then the most prevalent area of research is in the dissertations and theses. The one by FET, it's indirectly related, but it's still interesting. Dr. Gapples, again, this is like the beginnings of her research. It's really interesting. A lot of it is very technical, so you have to get through that, but it's very thorough. That was when she had started doing a lot of the testing with young kids. So then the Hall one, this is one of the newer ones from 2010, teaching the female Allison to sing, a survey of choral conductors and voice instructors. So it's more a survey of what people have had to say about it. So she more just like interviewed people, and this is what she came up with. The Melissa Mills one, that's why all students should sing in choir. So it's not necessarily about females, but if you're having trouble with a program getting cut or something, this is a great source to read about why kids need to be in choir. But again, it doesn't really have anything to do specifically. I mean, it talks about girls, but it's not specifically about girls, and it's not specifically about the church either. But it's a great way to have arguments for church choirs, which, I mean, there are a lot of programs getting cut, so that's important. The Simply one, this is early research too, so it's pretty primitive in the idea of where things came, but he does use case studies, which is great. And then the Tool one is the final one, and I thought this was a great source, because, I mean, it's not brand new, but it's fairly new, and I thought it was well written, so it was not too hard to understand what she was trying to say, and it really was very conclusive and explanatory, so I really enjoyed that one. But I think that's all that I have to present to you. Do y'all have any questions? I know I went through a lot of material in a short time.
That's very good.
So do you have any suggestions for when those 14, 15-year-old girls just won't sing better than that? You know, they just are so wimpy sounding, and they say, oh, I can't sing that high, and, you know.
Yeah. I think the best way that you can go about it is just vocalizing. And a lot of times, I've actually had experience with vocalizing kids, and they don't realize how high they're singing.
Yeah, I know that.
And then you say, well, you just sang higher than that piece that you don't want to sing, so I don't understand why you won't sing. So it's kind of a matter of proving them wrong without them knowing it. I was doing some private instruction with an 11-year-old this fall, and she didn't think that she could sing, and she had a very breathy voice, and she didn't like to sing more than about a fifth, like the typical pop range that you hear on the radio. And we went through some very simple little sirens or just little scalar passages, and she easily got up to a G5 without a problem. And I turned to her and I said, do you see how high I'm playing on the piano? She said, yeah. And I said, well, this is where you have to sing in your song. She said, oh, I guess I can sing that high. And then it wasn't a problem from there.
Yeah.
And some girls are going to be more stubborn, but I really do think it's a matter of just catching them off guard and then showing them, hey, you can do it. So I don't understand why. As far as the not using any color and using a wimpy sound, I think a lot of that is just really using motions to show them how they're supposed to sing, and demonstrations. I think also the kinds of demonstrations that I think are particularly effective are the ones that show them you overdoing it and then way underdoing it, and then having them repeat you on both, because they'll repeat you if they think it sounds ridiculous. And then you say, oh, so you can do it. And then you just say, oh, I want it somewhere in the middle. And then you help them find that place in the middle. But a lot of times they won't do what you're doing unless you overdo it and sound ridiculous. Mm-hmm. And then they'll help you. They'll meet you in the middle somewhere a lot of times. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, that's good help. Thanks.
Anybody else?
I work a lot with the diaphragm, too, and the support.
Mm-hmm.
I have them on the floor doing leg lifts. And when I teach, I'll go like this, and they will immediately give that support. And I'll tell them, if somebody's going to come punch you in this gut, what are you going to do? You're going to do this. And then they'll go, oh, wow, listen to that sound. And it's not using their throat. That drives me crazy because they're trying to, imitate who they're listening to on the radio. I mean, they just can't, you just can't do that. You have to find your voice. But it is, with my youth choir church, I have to have them right now, 6th grade, 12th grade, I have to have them together.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of hard.
That is hard.
I've got 7th through 12.
Yeah, and
all together.
That 7th and 8th grade changing voice with both male and female, and it's
yeah.
Yeah.
I still need to brush up on my male Ellison voice. I've been so fascinated by this, just because I think research that doesn't exist is so much more fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it took weeks and months and
yeah.
countless hours of digging to find even just these amount of sources.
I think, too, the self-confidence. I mean, that's the
mm-hmm.
huge issue that they all have, right, in that middle range
yeah.
of 11 to 15.
Absolutely.
And, sometimes if you work on that as much as anything, and
mm-hmm.
then just give them some helpful hints and say, oh, my gosh, and like you were saying, have them show them the difference. And they're like, and let them do it. And then all of a sudden, like, it is there. But, they want to hold back because
mm-hmm.
they're afraid of what somebody else
yeah.
will think about.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So, it is a huge confidence builder that I think we have to be. Sometimes I think that's all I am. That all I can do for them, But it makes a huge difference. I teach individual voice lessons
okay.
as well in the high school. But I've got 14-year-olds up to 17-year-olds.
Yeah.
And what a difference in those voices,
Mm-hmm.
And that's it. Most of it's confidence. I have just come to that conclusion.
Yeah. Oh, I completely agree.
Because all of a sudden there's a voice there that you had never heard before.
You go, where did that come from?
Whoa. And it's fun, when they hear
yeah.
it too. And you're like, wow.
Yeah.
So it's great.
Well, I don't know if y'all have watched very much Helen Kemp, but I think what she does with little kids is a great builder for confidence in choir, where she'll just say, now you sing this, now you sing this, now you sing this, and just giving people from the beginning chances to just sing in choir. And I wish that, I could start that with the youngest kids so that when they came to me, they were used to just singing out, because there's no embarrassment if everybody does it.
Yeah, everybody does it. I teach preschool also at lunch. Preschool through high school, and we started that with the preschool
mm-hmm.
year two. Do you want to sing by yourself? Okay, isn't that great?
Yeah.
And they go, oh, and then they think of it. They don't.
Yeah, it's totally normal.
They're about 4 years old. Yeah, and then they're kind of a little bit, But they love it.
But kids just can surprise you when you give them the opportunity. That's what I've found.
Mm-hmm.
No matter what the age, you want to sing? Okay, do it. They're like. And some are great and some are not so great.
Yeah.
But just giving them the opportunity. And some I have just been bowled over by,
mm-hmm.
just knocks you down in the air.
And that's one of the important things of choir anyway, in my opinion, is that they can build self-esteem.
Absolutely.
It helps them in everything else they do.
Everything else they do.
Public speaking and all that.
Absolutely.
And that's what I tell parents, too. Get them in choir. Get them out in front of people. That's what you need.
So are you working with choir? I missed the first part. So do you work with choirs?
Oh,
or?
I'm getting my second, I'm in my second year of my master's program here for church music. My ultimate goals, I would like to work with, I would like to build up a children's program, a children's music program at a church. And I teach private voice, so I'd like to continue doing that and build a studio wherever I end up. And I also like soloing with oratorio stuff. That's like my solo love. But right now I'm the director of children's music ministries at Austin Avenue United Methodist in here in Waco. So it's my first year in an official position. I've done a lot of internships, but it's exciting that I get to be the one who shapes the little ones now. So
how do you have them broken? I mean, do you have?
I only have one choir. They
which
are
is good
age? Ages. I think they're about. Well, it depends on who actually comes, but. It's somewhere between ages.
Yeah,
it's
yeah,
somewhere
yeah, yeah.
Between
the church music.
Yeah.
Right?
It's about 5th to 5th grade, so it's a big group. But I don't have enough kids to split them.
Yeah.
So, it's a there aren't a ton of young families. I've been doing some recruiting, so hopefully
I have a homeschool choir that goes from 2nd grade to 12th grade.
Oh wow!
And they are all together. So
wow!
You talk about a challenge. No, there's a challenge.
Yeah.
Now, but what I have done is I do break them up and let them do songs
mm-hmm.
individually, you know, the younger children, the older children. And that's a huge confidence builder for those older kids, and that's what really
yeah.
retains those older kids. But I also find that my younger kids will rise to the occasion
mm-hmm.
when I do give really challenging music. Not challenging in tessitura or anything like that, but challenging, you know, musically. And
yeah.
that's been great. Those older kids, they aspire to be like them. And so that pulls them right up, you know, very quickly. So
yeah.
it's interesting sometimes when you can't separate them, sometimes you
yeah.
realize some things that are positive about
I interned at a church where the age group was, you know, maybe a 4 or 5 year span, and what the director there, which I really liked, what she did is she would start with the younger kids, and then there would be a middle rehearsal with all of them,
mm-hmm.
and then she'd end with the older kids. And that's a great program if you have like an after school program that's going at the same time that you're just pulling the kids from. That doesn't always work, but if you do have to have that bigger choir, then you can have the time to work on the melody with the younger kids and the harmony with the older kids, and then maybe the older kids get to do an extra piece. I thought that was a great way of organizing it, just because they still got some time alone, but then you could still
yeah.
put them together and it would work. And that way you're teaching, you know, you can be working on different skills with the younger kids than the older kids. As far as, you know, teaching them solfege or sight reading or anything, because you don't want to repeat things for people.
Yeah.
That's no fun.
Thank you again for listening to this podcast. To learn more about the Alleluia Conference, visit us online at www.baylor.edu/alleluia.